So it is the fall of 2003, and welcome to this deep dive into the book, The Second Winter and the Spring of Deep Learning.
Right, and today we are focusing specifically on the chapter titled Manhattan's Jazz and the Deep Learning Conspiracy.
Exactly. And the chapter opens with this really vivid scene. We are in a subterranean jazz club in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, and sitting near the stage is a 43-year-old French researcher named Jan LeCun, and he's listening really intently to this improvised trumpet solo.
Yeah, totally improvised.
Right, like there is absolutely no sheet music in front of these musicians. They're not, following pre-programmed rules or anything. They're just creating brilliance completely on the fly.
Figuring it out as they go.
Exactly, reacting to each other and the acoustics of the room.
And I mean, the reason that specific scene in Greenwich Village anchors this chapter is because that musical improvisation, it perfectly represents the core philosophical desire LeCun had for machines.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, he wanted them to learn organically, from raw, unstructured data, adapting on the fly.
Rather than what they were doing at the time.
Right, without humans sitting down and explicitly hard coding every single rule. So the mission of this deep dive is to explore how that highly organic philosophy somehow survived this brutal period known as the AI winter.
Yeah, the AI winter was no joke.
It really wasn't. And we're going to look at the mechanics of how this underground academic resistance actually kept the concept alive and how it ultimately sparked the modern machine learning revolution that literally powers almost every piece of technology you use today.
Okay, let's unpack this because to really understand how LeCun eventually built systems capable of this fluid jazz-like learning, we really have to look at the immediate environment he was operating in back in 2003.
Right.
And his reality at that exact moment was incredibly fractured.
Very much so. I mean, by 2003, LeCun had recently left Bell Labs. And Bell Labs was historically, I mean, the premier incubator for technological
It's a
innovation.
golden standard.
Exactly. But it was suffering through these massive corporate breakups, the AT&T and Lucent dismantling.
Yeah.
So the highly empirical functional technology LeCun had developed there, and we're talking about neural network systems, they were actually reading millions of handwritten bank checks across America every day.
Which is wild for the time.
It really is, along with, groundbreaking image compression tech. But all of that was just being sold off and scattered as the parent companies were taken apart.
So he steps out of that corporate research environment and he arrives at New York University as the Jacob T. Schwartz Professor.
Yep.
And his physical placement on the NYU campus, it perfectly physicalizes the intellectual war he was about to fight.
It's almost too perfect.
Right. He literally places his desk, like his actual academic home, squarely between two totally distinct buildings. On one side, you have the current Institute of Mathematical Sciences, which is the bastion of traditional computing, rigid mathematical proofs, theoretical guarantees.
Very rigid.
And then on the other side is the Center for Neuroscience, which is dedicated to the messy, organic reality of the biological brain.
And that geographical choice was absolutely no accident. LeCun's fundamental architecture for machine learning, it came directly from neurobiology.
Right, he was looking at biological systems.
Exactly. He drew really heavy inspiration from David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel's Nobel Prize-winning research on the cat visual cortex.
Right, the cat experiments.
Yeah, Hubel and Wiesel demonstrated that biological vision, it doesn't just process an image all at once in a single flat layer. The brain processes raw visual data hierarchically.
Step by step.
Right. It extracts tiny points of contrast, which then feed into neurons that recognize simple lines, which then combine to recognize complex motifs, and it layers up to recognize distinct objects.
Okay, so building up from the smallest pieces.
Exactly. And LeCun looked at that biological hierarchy
Right.
and basically determined, well, machines must process information in the exact same layered manner.
The traditional academic world, however, and specifically the brilliant theoretical minds over at the current institute, violently disagreed with this.
Oh, completely.
They wanted absolutely nothing to do with neural networks. Academia in the early 2000s, I mean, they were entirely obsessed with support vector machines or SVMs.
SVMs were the gold standard for that.
Right. And the historical irony here is just staggering. The SVM was created by a man named Vladimir Vatnik, who had literally been LeCun's next door neighbor sharing a hallway back at Bell Labs.
The tension between those two former hallway neighbors, it really defined an entire decade of artificial intelligence research.
I can imagine.
The mathematicians at Current threw all their weight behind SVMs because SVMs relied on convex optimization.
Okay, meaning what exactly?
So to put it in geometric terms, a support vector machine essentially maps out a mathematical landscape with only one single valley of error.
Like a literal bowl.
Exactly. Because of the nature of convex functions, no matter where your algorithm starts on that landscape, you have a rigid mathematical guarantee that it will just roll down into that one single perfect global minimum.
So it's safe.
It was elegant. You could write a pristine, multi-page mathematical proof demonstrating exactly why it worked.
But neural networks did not offer that kind of comfort, did they?
Not at all.
Like, if an SVM is a landscape with one neat valley, a neural network is basically a chaotic, non-convex nightmare.
Right, actually. We are talking about models with millions of individual parameters, or weights. When you try to map the error landscape of a neural network, you don't get a single valley. Yeah. You get this jagged mountain range filled with thousands of local little pits and craters everywhere.
A total mess.
Yeah, and traditional mathematicians argue that if you drop an algorithm into that landscape, it's just going to get stuck in the first shallow crater it finds.
Right.
Furthermore, as you add more layers to a neural network, the mathematical signal that you use to correct the errors, with something called backpropagation, it gets exponentially smaller. It dilutes as it travels backward through the layers.
Oh, the vanishing gradient problem.
Exactly, the famous vanishing gradient problem. So because of these factors, the mathematicians just completely dismissed neural networks. They labeled them unproven hand tricks and basically derided them as black boxes because nobody could write a closed form equation to prove they would actually converge on a correct answer.
Wait, I need to push back on the logic of these academic mathematicians here.
Go for it.
LeCun's technology was already reading real messy American handwriting on bank checks every single day.
Right, at an industrial scale.
It worked in the real world. Yeah. So they basically demanded a perfect mathematical proof for the physics of how a bicycle stays upright. And because LeCun couldn't write the proof, they refused to acknowledge that he was already riding the bicycle around the parking lot.
What's fascinating here is that you've isolated the exact friction point between engineering and theoretical math. The academic world was absolutely choosing the comfort of a clean theoretical proof over empirical real-world utility.
Which is just wild to think about.
It is. LeCun had empirical proof. He had functional deployed code. Yet academia rejected it because it didn't satisfy their aesthetic preference for mathematical guarantees. Like you said, if you can't prove why the bicycle stays upright on a chalkboard, they just aren't interested in watching you ride it.
So because that traditional academic front door was deadbolted shut, LeCun and the very few allies he had left basically had to form an underground resistance.
Yeah, it was survival mode. The environment they were operating in was the second AI winter, which spanned roughly the late 1990s through the early 2000s.
Right.
And you have to understand, the censorship wasn't just a matter of, you know, polite academic disagreement. It was an active systemic purge.
Wow.
If a researcher submitted a paper to major prestigious computer vision conferences like CVPR or NEPS, and the title or the abstract contained the phrases neural network or backpropagation, the automated filtering systems or the peer reviewers would often just reject the paper outright without even reading the methodology.
Just based on the words alone.
The vocabulary itself triggered an automatic disqualification.
And Jeffrey Hinton, the brilliant researcher based up in Toronto, he made an incredibly potent historical comparison about this exact period.
He did.
He compared the treatment of neural network researchers to Alfred Wegener.
Right.
And Wegener was the geologist who proposed continental drift. And the scientific community mocked Wegener relentlessly because he couldn't explain the exact tectonic mechanism of how the continents moved.
Even though all the empirical evidence showed that they clearly did move.
Exactly. And the chilling effect on young scientists at this time was severe. Yoshua Bengio, who was operating out of Montreal, he has spoken openly about having to literally twist the arms of his own graduate students just to keep them researching neural networks.
Because they were terrified.
They were terrified. They were committing career suicide, facing permanent unemployment in a field that was just actively hostile to their work.
And that intense professional isolation, it forged a very tight-knit alliance between LeCun, Hinton, and Bengio. They basically became the architects of a resistance. LeCun actually jokingly referred to their localized alliance as the deep learning conspiracy.
I love that.
Others in the broader academic field, perhaps with a bit of suspicion regarding how closely they collaborated, called them the Canadian Mafia.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting to me. To bypass those automated rejection filters at the major academic conferences, This group deploys a brilliant piece of linguistic camouflage. They take their existing neural network research and they literally just rebrand it. They start heavily utilizing the term deep learning.
Yep.
And they use deep specifically to highlight the multi-layered architecture of their models, right?
Exactly.
But essentially, the grand, intimidating phrase deep learning, which is without question the defining technological buzzword of our modern era, it was originally just a marketing pivot to trick academic gatekeepers into actually reading their papers.
It was entirely a tactical maneuver for pure survival, and it ended up christening an entire era of human technology. They changed the packaging to smuggle the exact same biological layered philosophy right past the guards.
That is just brilliant.
But like, you know, rebranding only gets your paper read. It doesn't pay for the compute power of the grad students.
Right. We still need money.
Exactly. What fundamentally saved the philosophy was a massive financial intervention. In 2004, the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, or CIFAR, stepped in and funded Geoffrey Hinton's Neural Computation and Adaptive Perception Program, the NTAP.
That was a big deal.
It was an absolute lifeline. It provided this exiled group of computer scientists along with a vital mix of neuroscientists, physicists, and cognitive psychologists, a physical and financial sanctuary to just gather, iterate, and survive the academic freeze.
And just to maintain total historical clarity on the breakthroughs happening during this period, when M. Hinton eventually achieves a massive milestone in 2006 using a layer-by-layer pre-training method that makes these deep networks much easier to optimize.
Yes, it is definitely important to impartially note the priority dispute there. Following Hinton's highly publicized 2006 breakthrough, the German researcher Jürgen Schmidhuber firmly claimed that his own lab had actually published the foundational mechanics of that layer-by-layer pre-training way back in 1991.
So there's a real debate there.
Yeah. The historical credit for who unlocked which exact mathematical door first remains a heavily debated topic. But regardless of that specific priority dispute, the impact of the Canadian CIFAR funding in keeping the overarching philosophy from going extinct, I mean, it's undeniable.
Totally. So CIFAR money kept the lights on, but money alone doesn't solve complex non-convex optimization problems.
No, it doesn't.
To actually figure out how to make these multi-layered networks function practically, this resistance needed an intellectual environment entirely divorced from the rigid, proof-obsessed halls of the current institute.
They needed a different vibe completely.
Which brings us out of the laboratory and into a snowy mountain ski lodge in Utah.
The snowbird ski resort meetings.
Yeah.
These physical gatherings were originally initiated back in 1986 by two physicists from Bell Labs, John Denker and Larry Jackall. And as a crucial piece of connective tissue for our narrative today, Larry Jackall is the exact man who originally hired Jan LeCun at Bell Labs years prior.
That's such a great connection, but the immediate question that jumps out here is why physicists? If the computer scientists and mathematicians are abandoning artificial intelligence, why is a group of physicists stepping in to champion it?
It really comes down to how different disciplines approach the concept of a complex system. In 1982, a brilliant physicist named John Hotfield published a paper applying the statistical physics of magnetic materials to artificial neural networks.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, think of a block of magnetic material as a massive grid of tiny magnetic needles. These needles are constantly interacting, pushing and pulling on each other, flipping their spins until the entire block eventually settles into a stable, low-energy state. Mm-hmm. Physicists call this an Ising model. And Hopfield demonstrated that a neural network trying to minimize its error rate is mathematically isomorphic to a physical system trying to minimize its energy state.
Oh, wow. So when a mathematician looks at a neural network, they see a chaotic, unprovable black box. But when a physicist looks at it, they just see a natural thermodynamic system.
Exactly the distinction. Physicists are entirely comfortable with messy, dynamic systems involving millions of interacting parts like weather patterns or, you know, magnetic spins.
Right. They deal with that all the time.
They don't demand a single elegant equation to map every single variable before they even begin. They use statistical mechanics to understand the macro behavior of the system based on micro interactions. So they possess the exact mathematical language required to embrace the chaos that the computer scientists were completely terrified of.
And the atmosphere at these snowbird meetings sounds like absolute intellectual utopia. You have physicists, neuroscientists, computer engineers just skiing the Utah slopes during the day.
So they're pretty good, right?
Right. And then at night, They gather around a massive fireplace for these ruthless, deeply technical, yet highly collaborative whiteboard debates.
No rejection letters there.
No automated rejection letters. There's no demand for convex proofs. It is just raw empirical testing. And this fireplace is where LeCun relentlessly hammered home his foundational argument for a concept called compositionality.
Right, and compositionality is really the beating heart of LeCun's philosophy. He argued that the physical universe we occupy is inherently compositional. It is built in structural layers.
Okay.
If you take a digital photograph, for instance, at the base level, it is just raw pixels.
Just tiny dots.
Exactly. But pixels form small edges. Those edges combine to form complex motifs, like the curve of an eye or the tread of a tire. Those motifs combine into parts, and the parts form the complete object. LeCun argued that if the real world is built in layers, a machine intelligence must process data in layers.
Which is the direct opposite of what the academic establishment was doing with their support vector machines.
It's exactly right. With SVMs, the researchers were manually hand-coding the features. A human engineer would look at an image and literally write code to tell the machine exactly what an edge or a curve look like, and then feed that highly curated data into the SVM.
Hand holding the machine.
LeCun viewed that as a total dead end. He insisted that the machine must be exposed to the raw, unstructured pixels and learn the compositional hierarchy entirely on its own.
But LeCun didn't just bring abstract philosophy to these Utah debates. He and a French mathematician named Léon Botou brought a custom-built software environment called SN.
Yes.
And they used SN to evangelize a very specific and highly controversial mathematical approach for training these networks called stochastic gradient descent, or SGD.
And the debate over stochastic gradient descent really highlights the divide between theoretical math and engineering. In the 2000s, the traditional, mathematically safe way to train an algorithm was called batch gradient descent.
Okay, and how did that work?
You feed the machine your entire massive beta set all at once, you calculate the exact gradient of the error for the whole batch, and then you take one highly calculated, mathematically guaranteed step toward the solution.
But calculating the entire data set at once requires just an agonizing amount of compute power.
Massive amounts.
LeCun's SGD approach flips that completely. With SGD, instead of waiting to calculate the whole data set, you feed the network just one single piece of data, or maybe a tiny batch, calculate the error, and instantly update the system's weights.
Which completely horrified the theoretical mathematicians, because updating the weights based on just a single random sample means the algorithm will bounce around erratically. It introduces massive statistical noise into the learning process.
So to map this mechanically, tell me if this tracks. The traditional academic method of batch gradient descent is basically like standing at the top of a foggy mountain and refusing to move your feet until you have mathematically surveyed every single inch of the terrain to find the absolute perfect path down. Whereas LeCun's stochastic gradient descent is just taking a step in whatever direction feels the steepest right this second. It's incredibly messy. You might stumble over a rock. You bounce left and right. But because you are actually moving, you reach the bottom of the mountain infinitely faster than the guy still doing trigonometry at the summit.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, your analogy perfectly explains why the tech you use today actually functions. LeCun was and is an engineer. He brought functional working code to a knife fight of academic theories.
I love that phrasing.
He demonstrated that in the messy reality of massive data sets, injecting that statistical noise, taking those quick erratic steps, it actually prevents the algorithm from getting stuck in those shallow craters we talked about earlier.
Oh, the local minima.
Exactly. The noise bumps the network right out of those local minima. And that snowbird culture of demanding empirical working code over abstract theory is the exact reason why, when you unlock your smartphone with facial recognition today, or you ask a voice assistant a question, the neural network behind that technology was almost certainly trained using stochastic gradient descent.
It's just an incredible vindication for them. And eventually, the philosophy incubated in Utah and funded by the Canadian government grew too powerful and empirically too effective for the broader academic world to ignore anymore.
It couldn't be ignored.
The AI winter finally broke. And LeCun established a permanent, incredibly public stronghold right back where this entire story began in Manhattan.
The thaw became genuinely impossible to ignore around 2009. That was the year Jeffrey Hinton's students take these deep neural networks and applied them to a standard speech recognition dataset called TM8. they caused the established error rates to plummet so drastically that corporate giants like Microsoft, Google, and IBM almost immediately abandoned their legacy systems and pivoted entirely to neural networks.
Overnight, almost.
Yeah. And then in 2013, which is exactly 10 years after LeCun had placed his desk between those two opposing buildings, he was named the founding director of the brand new Center for Data Science at NYU.
And what stands out to me about the Center for Data Science is its structural autonomy. LeCun didn't allow it to be tucked away as a subcommittee under the computer science department or the math department.
No.
It was entirely independent. It was a physical stake in the ground.
It was a massive institutional statement. But more importantly, it allowed LeCun to execute a brilliant psychological turnaround. He essentially flips the script on the current institute mathematicians who had mocked him for a decade.
What does he do?
He doesn't shut them out. He literally walks across the campus to them and says, "You were absolutely right. Deep learning is a black box. We still don't have the convex proofs for why it navigates non-convex landscapes so beautifully." Which means I am handing you a massive, completely unexplored continent of mathematics just waiting for you to conquer it.
So what does this all mean for the field? He utilized the mathematicians' own defining trait, which is their deep, obsessive love for incredibly difficult, unsolved puzzles, and he weaponized it for his own cause.
Perfectly stated.
He turned his harshest academic critics into his most valuable co-investigators.
He is an absolute masterclass in academic diplomacy and structural psychology. And inside that center, he didn't just build models, he fostered an ecosystem. He mentored brilliant young researchers like Rhea Hadsell and Sumit Chopra, whose early work planted the critical seeds for what the field now calls self-supervised learning.
Huge names in the field now.
Exactly. But perhaps the most vital legacy he instituted at the NYU Center was an uncompromising demand for an open source culture.
That is so critical to the story. They resisted the urge to patent every single breakthrough and lock it behind corporate paywalls.
They published their code openly. They wanted a grad student in Mumbai to have the exact same access to the code base as a researcher in Silicon Valley. And this radical culture of openness directly laid the architectural groundwork for massive frameworks like PyTorch.
Right.
LeCun ensured that the mechanics of deep learning didn't become a walled garden controlled by a single entity. He ensured it became a decentralized global tool.
To zoom out and just look at the trajectory here, we go from a single researcher listening to jazz in a basement, entirely excommunicated by his peers, to fundamentally altering the global technological landscape.
The velocity of that shift is staggering. By 2012, neural networks utterly decimated the traditional hand-coded SVM models at the major ImageNet computer vision competitions.
It was a blowout.
It really was. And by late 2013, the largest technology conglomerates on Earth were scrambling to acquire this expertise. Mark Zuckerberg himself literally knocked on LeCun's door in Manhattan, successfully recruiting him to lead AI at Facebook, though LeCun fiercely negotiated to retain his academic post at NYU.
Well, yeah, he wasn't about to surrender the academic sanctuary he had just spent a decade bleeding to build.
Exactly. And the core takeaway for anyone trying to understand the modern AI landscape is that LeCun, Hinton, and Bengio didn't just preserve a specific string of code.
No.
By surviving through two devastating AI winters, by strategically utilizing Canadian funding, by seeking refuge in Utah ski lodges with physicists, and by drawing structural inspiration from Manhattan jazz clubs, they protected a unified philosophy of intelligence.
It's a whole new way of thinking about it.
Yes. They preserved the foundational idea that machines, much like biological humans, must be allowed to learn organically from the raw, chaotic, compositional layers of the real world, rather than being imprisoned by rigid, human-coded rules.
It is a profound study in intellectual resilience and, frankly, the danger of academic dogmatism.
It really is. But this raises an important question.
It really does. Because when you map this history out, if deep learning, which is undeniably the central defining technology of the 21st century, if it had to be secretly rebranded and smuggled past the automated rejection filters of the scientific establishment just to survive, you really have to wonder.
Right.
What brilliant, world-changing paradigm is currently being thrown in the trash today simply because the researcher refuses to use the establishment's right buzzwords?
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into the origins of deep learning.
We highly recommend exploring the full text of The Second Winter and The Spring of Deep Learning for even more insight into the history that built our modern world.